Lighting Up Time, a short story for the winter solstice. Written by Debbie Young and narrated by Siobhan Waring. Copyright Debbie Young, 2014. Forward. This short story was first published on the winter solstice, 21st of December, of 2013, as my contribution to a blog hop called Lighting Up the Darkness, organised by historical novelist Helen Hollick. It is a work of fiction, so any resemblance to real people, living or dead, or to real events, is purely coincidental. For the historical novelist Helen Hollick, whose passion for sharing stories inspired me to write this one. Lighting Up Time. After hitting the loudspeaker button, I flung my mobile phone down on my desk. I hoped that physically distancing myself from my sister Kate's voice might stop me giving in to her, but I knew I was already a lost cause to her wheedling tones. I wouldn't have asked you to babysit if our usual girl hadn't come down with a lurgy, but you know the rule. No contact until 48 hours after you've thrown up. I can't risk sentencing the whole family to a sickly Christmas. Kate's years of legal training had not been in vain. She can argue that black is white and people will believe her. And so it was that I found myself driving out of town, down unlit country lanes on the longest night. The winter solstice is the worst night of the year for anyone who, like me, is afraid of the dark. Even if it had been broad daylight, I was still not ready to go back to Kate's, just 6 months after last summer's tragedy. Well, okay, so it isn't really a tragedy when a 92-year-old woman dies. At work, I'm only allowed to use the word tragedy very sparingly when I'm writing up the obituaries. My editor would definitely blue-pencil it out in this case. But her death was traumatic for me, because I was the one who found her, and the 92-year-old woman in question was my lovely great-aunt Sophie. It was Midsummer's Eve, and we were all out at Kate's country house to celebrate her husband Tom's 40th birthday. Normally I'd consider it a treat to escape from the confines of my pokey city centre flat to soak up fancy food and drink at their expense. Tom's family own a posh car dealership, and what with Kate's salary as a lawyer as well, they are loaded. They'd pushed the boat out even further than usual this time because they were also celebrating Kate's promotion to partner at her legal firm. It felt more like a wedding than a birthday bash, with me, as ever, like the bridesmaid, never the bride. But I'm not complaining. I could get used to Prosecco. All the family were invited during the day, and friends and work colleagues were to join us for the evening. After games for all ages in the afternoon, there followed a buffet, then dancing to a live band in a marquee in the garden. The finale was a professional firework display, launched from the stable yard to give everyone a fine view from the vast terrace. It was a good thing there were no horses in the stables, only Tom's collection of classic cars. Great Aunt Sophie was at the daytime celebrations, as she had been at every family party that I could remember. She'd even been at our house when I was born. I love to hear her tell me of the first time she saw me, when I was just 2 minutes old. I had rosy pink cheeks, spiky fair hair, the loudest of cries, and two big tears in the corner of my scrunched-up little eyes. From the day of my arrival, Great Aunt Sophie was so much a part of my life that I couldn't imagine ever being without her, even though I knew we'd have to part eventually. Whenever I'd been away from her for long, such as when I went off to university for 3 years, I'd keep a little bottle of her favourite floral perfume in my handbag. That way I could get a little hint of her summery aura whenever I missed her. On that day last summer, she showed no sign of giving up the ghost, beating us all hollow at cards and charades. She was unimpressed by Tom's milestone birthday. 40? That's nothing. I'm in my 93rd year, I'll have you know. That's you twice over, young Tom. Plus Zoe and Archie too. Zoe and Archie are Tom and Kate's kids, aged 10 and 3. Zoe had recently mastered her times tables. So you're 9 times me, plus 1 Archie, she pronounced. No wonder you get so tired. Sure enough, Great Aunt Sophie was flagging by the time the evening guests arrived. She potted off contentedly to bed around 8 p.m., shrugging off sympathetic looks as she made herself her usual bedtime mug of cocoa. "I'll have the last laugh on you, my dears. I'll be fresh as a daisy at dawn while you're all nursing sore heads." I chinked my Prosecco glass against her mug, suspecting from my already spinning head that she'd be right. Next day, I woke up at 8:47 a.m., according to the clock that was ticking too loudly on the table beside my bed in Kate's guest room. Trying to remember exactly when and how I had got to bed, I staggered to the door. I kicked out my way the clothes I'd apparently discarded on the bedside rug the night before, and headed off on a quest for orange juice, my hangover remedy of choice. As I stepped out onto the landing, I had to squint against the sun that was streaming down through the stained glass window over the stairs, scattering coloured shadows across the pale parquet floor. I had to turn my head away from its glare. I caught sight at the far end of the corridor of a white heap crumpled at the foot of the full-length mirror on the wall. "Oh, God," I thought. "Someone's been sick in the night and dumped their sheets on the landing for Kate to wash. Charming." When my eyes adjusted to the shadows, I realised that it wasn't a soiled sheet, but a pristine cotton nightdress containing the frail body of my great-aunt Sophie. I ran to help her up, but even before I'd knelt down beside her, I realised that it was too late. Gently I stroked the papery skin on the back of her hand, as familiar as the taut flesh on my own. Though her hand still exuded the perfume of her favourite hand cream, night-scented stock, its raised veins were still. Only when I saw Tom reflected in the mirror, framed in the doorway of his and Kate's room behind us, did I realise that I had screamed out loud. Tom staggered across the landing to stand over us both, hands in his dressing-gown pockets.
"Christ, she looks how I feel," he began. "I thought Sophie was sticking to cocoa, but maybe she was the one who drained that litre bottle of sherry."
Kate hurried out from her bedroom to find out what all the fuss was about, hastily tying the belt of her silk kimono.
"Tom, you moron! Sophie's not drunk, she's bloody dead!"
Tom's face turned ashen. He must be mortified, I thought. No, that's the wrong word. Replace it with gutted. A more appropriate choice of vocabulary, it turned out, because straight away Tom dashed to the bathroom to be noisily, violently sick. Kate, meanwhile, all efficiency as ever, grabbed the nearest phone and took charge of the situation. Before lunchtime, a discreet black van, marked private ambulance, had swept up the drive and away again, taking great-aunt Sophie with them. I never saw her again. The post-mortem decreed she had died of natural causes, and after the funeral, life carried on for us all, except for great-aunt Sophie. The only difference for me, apart from her excruciating absence, was that I began to find excuses to avoid going back to Kate's house. I couldn't bear to see again the place where my beloved aunt had died. Until tonight, I thought Kate had understood. She had at least been letting me off the hook. I knew I'd have to go there sometime, but not for something as trivial as babysitting. I tried to engage my objective journalistic judgment. I was being foolish. I was letting the inevitable death of one very old lady cut me off from the rest of my family. I had to snap out of it. But why tonight of all nights? The longest, darkest night, which I usually spend at home, with my flat lit up like a Christmas tree and with something jolly on the telly. I don't know why the dark upsets me so, but I can't remember a time when it didn't. I always slept with a nightlight in my childhood bedroom, a much brighter one after Kate moved into her own room when she was about 12. I even took a nightlight away with me to university. For someone on a tight budget, I spend a ridiculous amount of money on electricity in winter, just so that I can keep lots of lights on. One of my friends, an environmental campaigner, only ever lights up the room she is actually in. If I had to do that in winter, I think I'd die. Either that or move to a bedsit, so I only had one room to worry about. Even keeping all the lights on is not enough for me. Although the power never goes off in the city, I keep a wind-up torch and candles in every room, in a place where I know I can put my hand on them, just in case we're ever plunged unexpectedly into the dark. I take comfort from the fact that from my tiny top-floor balcony, I can see lights twinkling all over the city. In a former life, I must have been a swallow. I'd love to be able to fly south as soon as the nights draw in. I'd only return when the nights were no longer than the time I need to sleep. What would happen if I had to spend time in the dark? I don't know, because I've never had the courage to find out.
When I got to Kate and Tom's, my heart was pounding. I forget just how dark the countryside is until I get to the point beyond street lights. I always drive the last 3 miles with a map reading light on in my car. I don't know how people live out in the sticks with only the moon and the stars to brighten the night. I pulled up my car as close as I could get it to Kate's front door. Thankfully, their security light came on just as I swung the car door open. My foot crunched down on the gravel, sounding for all the world as if I'd stepped on a pile of light bulbs. I let out a shriek. As Kate led me through to their living room, I could tell from the extravagant array of snacks on the coffee table that she had been feeling guilty about dragging me out on such a dark night. Olives, pistachios, kettle chips and Belgian chocolate lay alongside a newly opened bottle of Rioja and a single large wine glass. The sort they give you in pubs that nestle comfortingly in your hand but make you drink much more than you intend. She knows Rioja is my absolute favourite, even better than Prosecco in the winter. "I can't drink that. I've got to drive home later," I objected, already worrying that the lanes would be even darker after midnight. "Don't be stupid," said Kate. "You must stay the night. I've got the guest room ready for you." I thought it better not to tell her that I wasn't prepared to go upstairs, even though that's where the children's bedrooms were. What kind of babysitter was I? Kate chucked a couple more logs on the crackling fire before tipping about a third of the bottle into the glass on the coffee table. I glanced around the room, scanning for candles. I knew that power cuts were frequent in this old house on windy nights. I spotted 3 fancy-scented ones with multiple wicks in glass jars, the sort that cost as much as a standard lamp. I felt in my pocket to check for the matches and tiny torch that I always carry on winter nights. "We've got a taxi booked for 12:30, so we'll see you about 1, said Kate, wrapping a crimson pashmina about her shoulders. "Feel free to go to bed before we get back, if you want to." I scowled. There was no way I was going upstairs to bed, past all those shadows and dark corners, with no light switch within reach before you were halfway down the landing. I grabbed the Sky remote, ready to distract myself the minute Kate and Tom had gone. A moment later, a slight figure appeared in the living room doorway. "Hello, Emma," said Zoe. She had recently dropped the auntie title on the basis that she's nearly a teenager. Nearly? She's 10. She must be as bad at maths as Kate. Not having seen her for a few months, I was for a moment startled by how similar she is to Kate. Same long-lashed green eyes, same fine dark hair, falling in shiny waves to her shoulders, which, just like Kate, she shrugs in a particular lopsided way when she's restless or bored. In fact, I always think of Kate as being about 10, which is how old she was when I first became aware of ages. I'd have been 5. Archie is much more like me, with straight, lighter hair, blue eyes and a serious look. Sometimes when we're all out together, which has happened less often lately, people will assume he's mine and only Zoe belongs to Kate. It's funny how genes sometimes sidestep through family trees, taking with them distinctive mannerisms and ways of speaking as well as looks and personality. "Archie's in bed already because he's been a bit zonked since having his latest cold," Zoe was saying. "I'm off to bed now too. Night-night." She came over to give me and her mum a kiss. "Please will you tuck me in before you go out, Mum?" So much for the nearly teenager. I awoke, shivering on the sofa just after the 10 o'clock news had finished. The log fire had dwindled to ash, dotted with orange sparks. Hauling myself up from the sofa, I shuffled across to throw a handful of kindling onto the sparks, followed by a couple of logs. They weighed much less than I expected. Then I realised they'd have been stacked in the stables drying since the spring. What luxury to have so much space. The fire quickly revived and was soon crackling like gunshot in the grate. I jumped at every tiny explosion. Turning my stiff back to the fire to warm it, I remembered that I still hadn't adjusted my office chair as I'd been meaning to. Always too engrossed in bashing out my latest news story on the keyboard, I never remembered to adopt the health and safety approved posture until my back ached. It was only while surveying the room with a rapidly warming bottom, like some lordly Victorian gentleman, that I remembered that Kate and Tom didn't bother with curtains in their house. Facing me on every wall was a large blank window, giving a view of nothing but the blackest of nights. Wherever I turned, I could see a window, and I really didn't want to look. Ever since we read Henry James's The Turn of the Screw at school, when I was about 14, I've had a thing about curtainless windows at night.
The book includes terrifying scenes in which two servants, dismissed in disgrace, come back to press their face against the glass after dark, sinister with some unspoken threat. I cannot think of anything more frightening. The cold, dark threat of the unknown, emerging from the depths of one's own imagination. I'm not even sure now whether I've misremembered it, but I daren't go back and reread the book to check, in case it makes it worse rather than better. I cupped my hands around my eyes, attempting to create the effect of a horse's blinkers, and concentrated on the telly, my pulse loud in my ears. Rummaging in my pocket for my matches, I stooped down to light an exotic-looking five-wicked candle beside the fireplace. I didn't care how much it must have cost Kate. I just needed all the light that I could get. I tried to fool my brain into thinking I was relaxed by slumping back on the sofa and breathing slowly and deeply. The sound of my pulse was just receding when I heard the creaking of a door. With a shriek, I looked around, then realised with relief it had come from upstairs. It was probably Zoe going to the loo or getting a glass of water rather than a burglar or a ghost. I tried to attend to the panel game that was just starting up on Channel 4, ignoring the glass of Rioja, tempting me to take some Dutch courage. I heard the door creak again as Zoe pattered back across the parkade landing to her room. Then, just before the start of round three, a noisy coughing started upstairs. I shifted uncomfortably in my seat, hoping it would quickly abate. It sounded shrill, definitely Archie rather than Zoe. Zoe will sort him out, I told myself, hopefully. She doesn't need me to go upstairs. I'm not going upstairs. I'm staying by this bright and cosy fire. Archie continued to cough. The jasmine-scented candle was starting to weave its way down into my lungs and made me give a little cough of my own. Feeling my chest tighten brought me to my senses. Kate is my sister, I suddenly thought, and she's a lawyer, too. I can't let her son die of neglect, just because I'm too afraid to go upstairs. On impulse, I knocked back half the glass of Rioja, hoping there was still time for it to wear off before I had to drive home. Then I seized the pale shawl that lay artistically draped across the rocking chair and wrapped it tightly around my shoulders, like a symbolic armour against the dark on the stairs. Cautiously, I crossed the hall to the foot of the dark oak stairs and began to climb them carefully. "Please stop coughing. Please stop coughing," I urged Archie at every tread. "Don't make me come all the way up." I proceeded as quietly as I could, as if silence might reduce the danger lurking in the shadows. Archie went on coughing as I rounded the dogleg half-landing. The higher I went, the darker it was. The only source of light was a tiny glimmer of moonlight through the stained-glass window above the stairs. I couldn't believe Kate hadn't left the landing light on. Wasn't it dangerous to have unlit stairs? It wasn't as if she couldn't afford the bill. Archie's coughing was becoming shriller, tighter, grating on my nerves. "At least he's breathing," I comforted myself. "No real harm done yet." But what was Zoe thinking? Why wasn't she in there helping her poor little brother? Finally, I reached the top of the stairs and turned left towards the children's bedrooms. Then I stood stock still. For there, at the far end, who should I see but my aunt, standing in the spot where she had died? Great Aunt Sophie, shrouded in white, was staring back at me, her long pale hair adrift from her habitual bun and streaming down her shoulders, thicker and lusher than I had ever seen it in her life. Who was it that said, "Death becomes her"? I didn't know I'd screamed until Zoe flung open her bedroom door, flicking on the hall light switch and casting a full 100 watts upon me and Great Aunt Sophie. Except it wasn't Great Aunt Sophie at all, but me, like a frightened deer caught in car headlights, staring at myself in the mirror. That was when I realised Archie had stopped coughing. Tearing into his room with Zoe right behind me, I snapped on the light switch on the wall. No nightlights in this house, cruel mother that Kate is. I dropped to my knees at the side of his tiny bed. It's the sort that you pull out to make it bigger every time your child grows. It reminded me of a child-sized coffin. Archie's eyes were closed, cheeks pale, body still, and sticking out of his mouth was a small plastic toy zebra. I grabbed it quickly and flung it across the room, seized him by the shoulders and shook him. "Archie! Archie, breathe, for God's sake!" After what seemed like hours, He stirred slightly, took a noisy deep gasp, puffed it back out, and resumed his usual steady breathing, tinged with a snuffly baby snore. As I lay him gently back down on his side, hoping I hadn't dislocated any bones, he didn't even open his eyes. He just settled back down to the easy sleep of a small child. Zoe, meanwhile, calmly collected the toy zebra from the other side of the room, gave it a token wipe on her nighty, and stood it up neatly beside its twin on the gangplank of Archie's toy ark.
"I don't know why you're making such a drama out of it, Emma," said Zoe. "Anyone would think you were scared of the dark."
I emitted a false little laugh and hoped it fooled her. "Ha, ha. Back to bed now, Zoe, or your mum will be cross with you."
"No, she'll be cross with you, Auntie Emma," replied Zoe firmly, and trotted obediently back to bed.
After making sure there were no other choking hazards within Archie's reach, I pulled his door nearly closed, but not quite, just to be on the safe side, and turned back to stare at myself in the mirror. With Kate's pale wrap around me and with the shadows cast across my face by the moonlight, I really did look a lot like Great Aunt Sophie. As I stood there smiling at my reflection, I felt comforted. Maybe she wasn't as far away as I had thought. Pottering slowly back down the stairs, I began to wonder what my children would look like, if I ever get round to having any. Would they get any of Sophie's genes, or would they turn out like Kate, or Mum, or Dad, or me? I suppose I'd just have to wait and see. I'd finished the Rioja by the time Kate and Tom got home, and I was busy writing in the shorthand pad that I always keep in my satchel. I was making a list of the scented plants that I'm going to put in my window boxes this spring. Narcissus, wallflowers, hyacinths, and, of course, Great-Aunt Sophie's favourite night-scented stock. I'm looking forward to sitting on my balcony when the days are at their longest, a glass of something cool and refreshing in my hand, looking out across the cityscape rooftops and breathing in the perfumes of the flowers of the long summer nights. Kate thought I didn't notice her fall off her designer heels as she got out of the car on the drive, but I'd been watching them through the big front in the lounge. "Kate, have you ever noticed how much I look like Great-Aunt Sophie?" I asked her casually, as she took off her shoes and flung her crimson pashmina over the back of the rocking chair. She gave me that knowing look that only big sisters can pull off.
"Of course you bloody do. Have you only just noticed? Now get to bed. You look knackered."
"Okay." I heaved myself up from my comfortable wallowing position on Kate's soft leather sofa and gave her a good night kiss, though not so light that it didn't leave a little Rioja stain on her cheek.
"Thanks for having me," I said unnecessarily, before making my way up to the guest room, not forgetting on the way past the mirror on the landing to give Great Aunt Sophie a little wave.
Thank you. Thank you for listening to this story. If you enjoyed it, please recommend it to your friends. The author would be very grateful if you could spare a moment to post a brief review online on the website of your choice. You have been listening to Lighting Up Time, a short story for the winter solstice, written by Debbie Young, narrated by Siobhan Waring.